Good morning. I'm going to talk now. Can you hear me all right? I'm going to give you a little warning, first of all, that we don't know what I'm going to say. And I don't know, and you don't know, and we'll find out, kind of together. And what this means is that my talk doesn't go 1, 2, 3, 4, 1A, 1B, 1C, 2A, 2, you know, it doesn't go in order. It doesn't have a layout. It doesn't have an outline. My talk will be the way that my mind, body, being works in conjunction with being present in this room with you. Okay? You ready for that? This is an interesting point, you know, because sometimes people have complained, or occasionally, you know, I hear people say, that's very nice, Ed, but it's not Zen. Or that's very nice, but that's not Buddhism. That's just you. So, see, is there a difference between you and Buddhism or between you and Zen? And are you trying to get them to be the same? And how would it end up that they're the same? Mostly, you know, we start out thinking that we're far away from Buddhism and that if we practice enough, we could become Buddhists. Or we could practice being Buddhists. Do you understand? And then you could eventually be a Buddhist. Now, would this be, you know, recently I was working on a little article for Buddha Dharma magazine. Is your practice working? Of course, how would you know? As someone put it, I don't have the me who didn't practice as the controlled sample to compare myself who did practice with. You know? So, I may say more about this, but so I'm working on, you know, is your practice working? So we start out practicing with some idea of, a good way to be. What would be an improvement on me? Because as you, most of us, you know, have never in our lives been good enough. We didn't do baby very well. We didn't do two very well, three very well, and so forth, you know. And mom and dad went on being mom and dad. We didn't save them, you know, by, you know, usually mom and dad, you know, we have the ideas, mom and dad, we say to our babies, you know, make me happy, please me, don't disappoint me, grow up healthy. You know, don't have a tantrum. Don't be exuberant. Fit in. Don't stand out. So then, you can eventually become a Buddhist and hear the same things. And then all the things you've been trying to do all your life, Buddhism tells you to do. Now you have spiritual backing to go on and try even harder to be the you that you never could be. That you always thought you should be. Right? Isn't this great? It's also kind of, you know, sad. So I'm someone who, I decided pretty early on, it's not a good idea to express feelings. Some of you may have made a similar decision, you know, in the context of your family. They probably, you know, most families don't want to hear about your feelings, especially if they're unpleasant ones. So keep it to yourself, or go to your room until you don't have them anymore, or whatever it is, you know. Or maybe, you know, have some ice cream. You'll feel better. So eventually you can study Buddhism and they say, silence is really spiritual. Good idea to be silent and not express your feelings. Especially the unpleasant ones, because you might harm somebody else with your unpleasant feelings. They might be afflictive to you and to others, so it's best not to notice them. That would be a spiritual way to be. So it fits in with what you've been trying to do all your life, and now it's Zen, now it's Vipassana, now it's Buddhist. And I'm really doing my best to be a spiritual, virtuous, spiritual person. Isn't this great? So how's it going? Oh boy. So it turns out that actually, and then, you know, we can get sort of disillusioned, like, this is still not working. You know, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, it's still not working. And then you could become depressed. I still can't be this person I've been trying to be, silent, spiritual, keep my afflictive feelings from arising in me or, you know, bouncing off of others. And this is spiritual. Fit in. Do what you're told. See if you can please the authorities. Now they're the spiritual authorities that you've transferred from mom and dad onto the spiritual authorities, seeking their approval. Ah. So anyway, this is can be kind of disillusioning and depressing at some point, that it's not working out and that you haven't still succeeded in becoming the person that would get the approval that you've always wanted. Of course, it turns out that that's probably not coming from outside, but oh well. So I'm going to, I think what I'm going to do here is I'm going to give you a little official Buddhism, official Zen, okay? Just to give you a little sort of a context. And I might refer to the official context or I might not, and then you can refer to it or not. And by the way, you know, you'll each hear what you hear and do with it whatever you want to do with it. I don't care, you know. It's you're you, and I don't have to do anything one way or another in your lives, you know. And but this is a challenge, isn't it? How can you go on being you and also not go on being you? Anyway, how could you actually grow or develop or mature or become liberated or free in your life? And my idea, by the way, of, you know, for today at least, of freedom, liberation, would be from the commitment and devotion you have to all these ways of being, which you now call spiritual. And now it's become a prison to be silent, still, calm, clear, unemotional, friendly, kind, compassionate, wise. You know, how's it going? And usually it's not going very well. all right, so here I'm going to give you some Dogen, you know, from the Japanese founder of Soto Zen in Japan, prolific writer. So in one of his passages he says, when you attain realization, you do not think, aha, realization, just as I expected. Even if you think so, realization invariably differs from your expectation. Realization does not take place as previously conceived. realization always differs from your conception. Therefore, what you think one way or another before realization is not a help for realization. Past thoughts, though, were in themselves already realization, but you thought and you said, these thoughts can't be realization. Realization comes forth far beyond your thinking. Realization comes forth by the power of realization. Otherwise, it wouldn't be trustworthy. A spring has the flavor of spring. Autumn, the flavor of autumn. Complete upright enlightenment is like seeing someone for the first time and not thinking about whether you like them or not. It's like viewing flowers or the moon and not wishing for more color or brightness. I guess I will say a little bit about this. Realization, when you attain or experience realization, you do not think, aha, this is realization, just as I expected. But you see, it's so hard, isn't it? We have these pictures and these images and these ideas about what would be an acceptable mind and body to have, one that meets my approval finally. You know, or is it a moment that this moment, whatever our experience is, we compare to some idealized picture or image of how we could be or should be, or what's spiritual, what's Buddhist, what's Zen, what's Vipassana, and we say, oh, when I can look at my scale, my standard of measure, it doesn't measure up. So, you know, what are we going to do? Yes? Do you understand? How will you ever become acceptable if you can never measure up to your scale or standard? Someone once asked the poet Bill Stafford, oh, I hear you write a poem every day. And he said, yes, I do. I start in the morning and then I have to get the lunch for the kids and get them off to school. And I put the poem on a little shelf and I might have some time in the afternoon. And if not any sooner, I get it out in the evening before I go to bed and I finish it. And the interviewer said, well, how can you write a poem every day? I mean, you can't be inspired every day, day after day. And he said, I lower my standards. So I've been at this, business of being alive and business of Buddhism for a long time. It's a little unclear, you know, which is which. One of my teachers, Richard Baker, she used to say, you're Buddhism. My teacher, Suzuki Roshi, said, all of Buddhism is just for you. And this is like saying, you know, when will it be, or is it now okay for you to be you? Do you belong here in this world? Are you at home? Can you, you know, welcome yourself home? I am after, you know, after 19 years of practicing Zen, I was the head resident teacher at Tassajara. I was in charge of a practice period, you know, 90-day retreat period. It was the spring of 1984. So one day I was sitting in the meditation hall and I thought, what shall I do today? Do you have any little projects you do while you're sitting? Anything you kind of would like to take care of or handle or accomplish or produce or manufacture or establish or create or prove or demonstrate? I was so concentrated today. I didn't move. Whatever. I've been very busy, you know, for years. A lot of, you know, inexpensive Zen training. And so that day I thought to myself, why don't I just touch what's inside with some warmth and with some loving kindness? I'd been, you know, practicing Zen. So as soon as I thought that, the tears just started pouring down my face. Little voice said, "It's about time." This is how easy it is to, you know, practice something that you call Buddhism or, you know, spiritual, as a way to, you know, hide yourself from yourself. Trying, you know, endlessly to improve yourself. Suzuki Roshi said, "Oh, you Westerners," this is back in the 60s, you know, the people's bakery is making bread and giving it away for free and, you know, flower power and everything. People, you know, turn on, tune in, drop out. And he says, you know, improvement is based on the idea of comparative value. And I see, you know, many of you here at Zen Center you've rejected the idea of the materialistic culture, but you're still interested in improvement, aren't you? Don't you think that's rather materialistic? So I went to Kagyur Roshi and I said, "Kagyur Roshi, you know, I decided in meditation just to touch what's inside. Is that okay? Is that Zen? I mean, you'd want to be sure that you're doing the spiritual practice, right? Could you just be you? Could you just have your feelings, your thoughts, your body, your mind?" And so I asked him, "Is this all right? Is this Zen?" Kagyur Roshi said, he was pretty, you know, formal a lot of the time. And so he sat up very straight and he said, "Ed, for 20 years I tried to do the Zazen of Dogen before I realized there was no such thing." Again, you know, a little voice says, "Oh, right on schedule." So this is when, you know, practice gets a lot harder. A lot harder. Do you understand? When you have all these little spiritual projects, to sit still or not move or be calm or, you know, to be concentrated, to follow your breath, to note things or, you know. And then you can measure and mark how you're doing. Charlotte Silver, some of you know Charlotte Silver? You know, taught sensory awareness for 70 years or something. No, she died a year or two ago. She was 102. Her most recent husband was 56 or something. She outlived, no, she didn't outlive her third husband. But she said that, you know, she wanted to study when she was in Germany with a woman named Elsa Gidlow, or Gindler. Anyway, and she went to Elsa and she said, I want to study with you. And Elsa said, what have you been studying so far? And she said, oh, I'm a dancer and I've studied yoga and I'm teaching people yoga and dance. And Elsa said, you know too much. You can't be my student. And Charlotte persisted. Finally, Elsa said, all right, you can come to classes. And Charlotte said, for the first year, she had such a wonderful time. Elsa was so profound, and everything she said was so brilliant. But it seemed like Elsa didn't really kind of recognize or appreciate her being there so much. And finally, after something over a year, Charlotte said that one day Elsa said, Charlotte, at last, an authentic movement. You're not just posturing. And she could see it. You know, what's the difference between how you usually do, how you're attempting to do you in a way that, you know, gives the right impression to the world, and how you can, you know, be you. Is there a difference? You know, and, you know, you can see it, you know, especially like if you're at a cocktail party and people have, I'm fine, how are you? Isn't this fun? Aren't we having a good time? And anyway, we're all trying to figure this out, aren't we? But Charlotte said, once Elsa mentioned, at last, an authentic movement, Charlotte said, it got really hard after that. Because now you start actually feeling, being yourself, experiencing your feelings, knowing your thoughts, being in your body. And there's a lot of, you know, closets. There's a lot of faucets or spiritual pathways that have been shut off, energetic pathways that have been closed down. And once you start turning on the faucets, that's not quite right to say once you start turning on the faucets. Once the faucets start coming on, then you start having, you know, you might be angry, you might be sad, you might be scared. It's all the things that you weren't going to feel. They weren't spiritual. They weren't what you were aiming to be, to show how much you finally succeeded. So now, you know, another 20 years has gone by. I've spent 20 years now feeling what's inside. I've discovered a lot of things. You know, like, oh, 5 or 6, maybe 8 years ago, I was doing a workshop. It's kind of hands-on healing work that I study. And we did spatial displacement on purpose. You know, you just take all the consciousness that could be your left leg and put it anywhere but your left leg. And all, you know, the consciousness that could be your right leg and put it anywhere but your right leg. And you just do this for your left arm and your right arm and your torso and your head and your neck, and you can be you too can be a spiritual person. We'd done this exercise and it was so familiar. I found out that I was really good at spatial displacement just kind of naturally. Some of you may understand, you know, where this comes from. Men tend to be a little bit better at spatial displacement and women tend to be a little better at temporal displacement, by the way. But once I realized how spatially displaced I was, which, you know, in other kinds of jargon they know as dissociation, and it comes from, you know, trauma, and you want to be careful not to show up today because the same traumatic thing that happened before might happen today if you actually showed up. So maybe it would be safer not to show up, not to be present, not to be here, not to be in your body. Do you understand? So we all have versions of this. I don't think I'm, you know, particularly unique that way. But, you know, for instance, I finally found out, kind of accidentally, my brother was here 1 year or two, and he said, called up and said, can I come and visit? And I said, I don't think so. I don't feel like it. And he said, what's up? And I said, well, you know, I'm really sad and depressed, and I don't feel like seeing anybody. By the way, if you're a Zen teacher or a Buddhist teacher, this is not a good career move to mention to your students that you're depressed, because nobody wants to study, you know, very few people want to study with, you know, a teacher who's depressed, because you want somebody. There's two basic theories, you know, about teaching. You know, one is the teachers who are masterful, and if you do what I tell you, then you too could be masterful. And don't I look great? And you too could be great. And just do what I tell you, and then you'll, you know, find that you could be masterful too. And then the other kind of teacher is, oh, you're scared? Me too. I'm scared too. And, you know, I'm not minding. Maybe you wouldn't have to mind either. And we could both be human beings, you know, and we could kind of hang out with each other. And wouldn't that be fun? But when I told my sitting group that I was depressed, I got 3 phone calls the next day, which kind of covers the range of things. One was, I felt so honored that you would trust us to share with us your deep feelings. And then there was, you want to have lunch? And then there was, Ed, this is a chemical problem. Get some meds. But as far as I can tell, depression is, well, there's 2 things, you know, obviously. Classically, you know, depression is, you'd rather be depressed than angry. You know, you decide this at some point in your life without even knowing that you're deciding this, but it's better to be depressed than angry. And so, you know, once you're willing to be angry, you don't have to be depressed anymore. And then the other interesting thing, as I mentioned earlier, you know, about depression is, it's not working, is it, to become this person you set out to be? The perfect spiritual person that appears in the world and then mom and dad suddenly don't have financial problems and they're not depressed and they're happy and cheerful and they've gotten over all their issues. Because finally you are the person that you should have been when you were two. Does this make any sense to you? I don't know. Anyway, you don't have to understand because we're hanging out together and that's the important point. So anyway, I told my brother I'm depressed. And so he went home. It was this particular time of year. It's like early April. And then the next day he emailed me and he said, I've been going through the old family letters and here's one our father wrote to our uncle, you know, that later came back to us. And it said, me, the baby was born on March the 24th. The baby was due on April the 26th and was born on March the 24th. Frances, my mother, went home from the hospital the 31st. The baby came home April the 16th. So she, my mother, had a very good rest. Apparently what was happening to that baby is rather unremarkable. You know, it's not worth remarking upon what was happening to baby who was in the, you know, the hospital someplace with nobody particularly around. And, you know, what could be more like that than meditation? You sit in a room with all these people, and in Zen it's even better because we line up. You know, we sit in rows. So we each have our own little cubicle. And there's no possibility of contact or relationship or connection. Like, you don't relate to anybody. You're doing your practice. So, in this sense, you see, was practicing Zen all those years, was that post-traumatic reenactment? Called spiritual practice? In the guise of spiritual practice? Or, when I was in the incubator, or and nobody was around, I was just, you know, it's the acorn theory, you know, you're getting ready for your future destiny as a Zen practitioner. So start early. Get used to it. Alone in the void. So this is, it's not quite clear, you know, what we're doing. It's hard to sort all this out. What's the direction to go? You know, what are you up to? What's, you know, really important here for you and your life and for your realization to unfold, for you to be you? You know, Suzuki Roshi said, when you are you, Zen is Zen. Not when you get to be Zen enough, then you're cool. You know, when you finally measure up, we'll say, congratulations. So now I'm ready to start on the next 20 years. So now it seems like at last, you know, finally, I've 40 years of Buddhist practice, well, 39, you know, and 39 and a half now. And finally now in the last, you know, 2 months, I've been experiencing the grief I've spent my life avoiding and longed to have all my life. And you know, it's not just being born premature. My mother died when I was 3. And, you know, there's all the childhood and being in an orphanage. And then, you know, not making friends very easily. And then being kind of not very connected with people. And then all the relationships that don't work out. You know, friends who commit suicide. Things happen. And it's taken years to kind of, you know, keep deciding over and over again, do you want to be here? Do you want to be in your body, in this place, in this time? Because this is extremely, I've found over the years, extremely challenging. As I mentioned, once you start inhabiting yourself, you know, one of my friends said, she had a lot of trouble with alcohol and drugs, and then she met these spiritual people who were practicing. And they were so nice and so wonderful, and so she thought, maybe I'll practice too. And then, you know, it's the same thing. She said, so I started practicing, and I just took all those problems and I put them in the closet, and then I closed the door to the closet, and I put up a beautiful brick wall, and I hung up a tonka. And I was spiritual. Spiritual person, practicing the way. And then what happened, you know, after a while, you know, 6 years, 8 years, 10 years, 12 years, 15 years, at some point she couldn't keep the door closed. The closet. The things inside start pouring out. Because as you start to breathe, you follow your breath, you start inhabiting your body, and then pretty soon your breath is moving into places where you can't keep the closet closed anymore. And you start to find out what's been locked and hidden away. It turns out that actually what you think of usually is like, oh, my practice isn't working because I can't keep the closet closed, is actually your practice is working because this stuff is starting to pour out now. Do you understand? You're actually feeling things. You're actually feeling you're coming alive. So she said, you know, after a while, finally she started going to AA meetings. And, you know, at AA meetings, you actually get to talk about what's going on in your life. And what you're feeling. What's happening. And she, you know, she still meditates. But this is, to me, so, you know, the energetic pathways in your body start to open, and then there's some debris. This is like the pipes that you haven't turned on for a while. You turn it on, and some rust and crud comes out. This is ancient feelings that you were never going to have. And then after a while, when you meet or acknowledge things, you know, in mindfulness, then pretty soon the water's running clear. And you have energy and vitality that you can use in a variety of ways. Rather than, I have to be careful not to say this and to say that and to do this and not do that so that I don't happen to turn on any faucets inside. Do you understand? So Suzuki Roshi said, don't spend your whole life hiding your weak point. This takes a lot of energy. Or as another friend of mine said, it's not true we only use 5% of our mental capacity. We use 95% of our mental capacity to hold back the other 5%. So of course you don't have any, you know, real energy and exuberance and vitality because you're keeping yourself in check just to be sure that you behave the right way. That you'll look good. That you'll finally measure up. And it's going to be this and not be that. And so after the first 20 years, by the way, you know, I had to leave Zen Center, I felt, in order to feel what's inside, because it didn't seem appropriate to be a teacher and, you know, be crying a lot, you know. And it didn't seem appropriate to be a teacher and have, you know, temper tantrums. And so now, you know, finishing the second 20 years, it seems like in order to really have my grief, you know, well, after I was left Zen Center for 20 years, I've been in a relationship. In many ways, very wonderful relationship. And now last April it ended. You know, these things can, you know, it's got to be like that, right? The time of year when I was in an incubator And also the same time of year my mom died when I was 3, when else would somebody leave you? It's like right on schedule. So now I get to feel, you know, so in order to have my grief, I've actually had to, you know, be out of this relationship because it didn't work to have, in the same way it didn't work to be a Zen teacher and cry, you know, it didn't work to have a relationship and do all this stuff either. So it's all interesting, isn't it? So it's just about time for me to stop. I was told that you expected me to stop. Now it looks like it's about 10:45. So, you know, I just want to remind you that when you attain realization, it might not look the way you thought it would. Sure, you've got some great pictures. And in this sense, you know, this word in Japanese for realization is also translated manifestation, actualization. Each moment of reality is, you know, in a kind of colloquial sense, uncalled for. And that uncalled for has these two sides, you know. It's uncalled for because it's not what you wanted and or were looking for or were intending to have happen next. And it's also uncalled for in the sense of being, you know, free of your striving and contriving and planning and strategies. Dogen also says, if they were going to work, wouldn't they have worked by now? You've been doing them how long? Would you like a poem? There's a lot of poems I rather like. This one is the one that I'm thinking of now to share with you is, you know, Derek Walcott's poem, Love After Love. And it's in Roger Housden's book, 10 Poems to Change Your Life, the original one. One day, with elation, you will greet yourself arriving at your own door, in your own mirror. Each will say to the other, each will smile, greeting the other saying, sit here, sit here, eat, sit here, eat. You will love again the stranger who was yourself. Give wine, give bread, give back your heart to itself, to the stranger who's loved you all your life, whom you have ignored for others, who knows you by heart. Take down the photographs from the bookshelf. The dusty notes. Peel your image back from the mirror and sit. Feast. Feast on your life. You greet yourself arriving here in your own body, in your own being, feeling what you feel, sensing what you sense. And, you know, it turns out that we can come home to our hearts, can actually have, you know, your awareness in your heart. We share a tender, a sweet, you know, good heart. Heart energy is, you know, throughout the world. I wish you well in your practice. I hope it works for you. you know, coming home to your heart, letting your heart respond. Many blessings. Thank you.